Blog Talk Radio. Blog Talk Radio.
To inform, inspire, and empower Alcoholics Anonymous sponsorship, locally and internationally, to be their very best, both personally and spiritually. This is the mission of RumRadio.org, an internet radio program dedicated to carrying the message of recovery to a world plagued by alcoholism and addiction. Alcoholism and addiction is the number one health issue in our world today, and RumRadio.org is actively participating in the solution. Interviews with a plethora of people sharing their experience, strength, and hope. Live Sundays at 9 p.m. Central Time and rewound again on Saturday and Monday. Tune into 12-Stepology at its best on RumRadio.org.
Welcome and hello. This is Joseph G. with Rum Radio and RumRadio.org, the most comprehensive 12-step sponsorship in the known and the unknown universe. And this is a special meet, special program. This is a nooner. We'll be replaying this during the week. Yeah, it's a nooner. Well, 1 o'clock, depending on where you're at. During the drinking days, you know, I never drank until the sun was over the yard arm. But one thing I was for sure, that the sun was over the yard arm somewhere. So I didn't make it specific. I'd like to acknowledge WNAH, Hoyt Carter, and Tony the Horse, who affords us the opportunity to broadcast live to their listening audience in Nashville, parts of Kentucky, and Sweet Home, Alabama. And they do this as a public service presentation. That means they do it for free, and that's a great cost. We had to negotiate free. That's how much little money we had. They said free. I said, look, we're going to have to negotiate that. Could you cut that in half? We also like to acknowledge RecoveryToday.net magazine. It's one of the finer recovery journals that affords us some print space from time to time. I'd gratefully like to introduce my co-host, Harold B. He's a family intervention specialist. He does a fine work with troubled families, and I personally believe the families are the basic unit of our society, and as the family goes, so does the country, so does the nation, basically so does the world. What we have found is most of the problems we have with drugs and alcohol, not all, but most, is because of children that have not been taught correct principles. Once you teach a child correct principles, now they can teach themselves because they have a foundation of morality and laws and understandings. Without that foundation, it's the mean streets, latchkey kids, empty lot weeds. It's just growing up in the gangs and the clubs, and it's, you know, was it sex, drug, sex, and rock and roll? I mean, it worked for me for years, and that's primarily what we're dealing with. We're epidemic. You know, the drugs and alcohol are an epidemic proportion. We have a lot of different fellowships, but I like to remember one thing. 5 times as many people die from alcohol than all the other drugs combined. Wow. Why? Well, think about it. It's the most available. Drugs, you have to go through extra efforts to get drugs, and they're more costly. Liquor can be found fairly readily on almost every street corner in America, depending on where you live. So it's always the drug of last choice, it's an equal opportunity. But the drugs, too, take their toll. I like to think of drugs and alcohol as an equal opportunity destroyers. And at Rum Radio, we try to pick up the pieces that we had back in the 30s when they first put this thing together, which is great. They had a great recovery rate. I just wrote to it. 50% got well right away and another 25% after a few relapses. Wow, 75% recovery rate. I'll take that any day. It doesn't seem to be the case, but, you know, there's no numbers to validate either way. But personal experience shows that it's not quite is good. We do have a lot of people, millions have recovered from a hopeless state in mind and body. Don't get me wrong. Bill W., one of our co-founders, used to say, good is oftentimes an enemy to the best. So at Rum Radio, what we try to do is we try to aim for that best. What can we do better to help the next sufferer? And that's what we do. That's our agreement in AA and NA and CA. And by the way, we're not affiliated with Alcoholics Anonymous. We're not affiliated with Narcotics Anonymous, NA, or affiliated with CA, Cocaine Anonymous. We're Rum Radio and rumradio.org. We're closer to Paranoids Anonymous. The only problem is nobody will tell you where they hold the meetings. And if you've been sleeping through your recovery, you can consider this a wake-up call for Narcoleptics Anonymous. So we're telling you, okay, guys, it's time to get it back into action. Get off your rump. The meetings are great. That's the fellowship. But the work is a sponsor taking a sponsee through the steps. That's the work we do. And we carry that message. And we find our sponsees at the clubs, at the groups, and that's why we go there, to support that, find our new prospect. But we can go to halfway houses and three-quarter houses. We can go to the missions. We can go to the VA. There's plenty of places. The rehabs, we're missing. What a boat we're missing with the rehabs. They've already spent the money to gather the sheep, and they would more than likely like the help bringing a meeting, maybe to make you helping them make a transition from rehab to AA and the other sister fellowships. What a great idea. The only problem with great ideas is you got to find a wheelbarrow. People have to be willing to get uncomfortable. Along with this, Bill W. said, pain was the touchstone of all spiritual growth. And you can't grow spiritually and be comfortable at the same time. Harold, how you doing today?
I'm doing great. Thank you, Joseph. Thanks for that introduction. Thanks for putting together the radio program and the website. I want our listeners to know that this is not a money-making proposition for anyone. In fact, Joseph has sunk thousands of dollars into establishing and maintaining the website, and the same thing with the radio program. He put that out of his own pocket. That's his way of giving back. And being on the program is our way of giving back, our guest today and myself. So I consider it an honor to be here. And we're ready to tell you exactly what our experience, strength, and hope has been. If it hadn't been for the steps and a sponsor that was really dedicated to the big book, I wouldn't be alive today, and so that's why I'm here this afternoon on the program. So I have Chapter 5, How It Works, here, if you need me to read it, Joseph. Let's turn it back.
Oh, yeah,
to
why don't
you
do that? Yeah, would you, usually, well, I want to check on Kirk. Are you there, Kirk?
I am here.
You want me to use your last name or the last initial? How do you want to do that?
Oh, I will go ahead and use my last name. My name is Kirk Zajac. I'm a person in long-term recovery, and it is an honor and a pleasure to be here with you guys this afternoon.
Oh, cool. Thank you.
Thank you.
What's that sign that they took down at Lamplighters that you balked at, Harold, about anytime, anywhere? What does that say? What's that sign say?
Yes, anytime, anywhere anyone reaches out, we are obligated to reach back and answer the... It's all about 12-step work. 12-step work means going out and helping the person who would like some help. I used to do a lot of it with my first sponsor.
You know, the problem, I don't know if you know this, in Houston, of course, I can't speak for the world, and I'm trying to, but I can barely speak for myself. But here in Houston, our experiences, there was a 250-man waiting list to go out on 12-step calls at the intergroup. It's a clearinghouse when people call in. They're desperate, and they're trying to find out where the meeting is and how do they get to AA. They might have some questions. They might be suicidal. Who knows? But a 12-step call usually is someone has reached certain bottom. They're drunked out. They're drugged out. They're going to call up. They finally got this moment of clarity. They're going to make a phone call and see if there's something they can do to get out of this quagmire of insanity. And they'll call up, and they pass the calls on to two people. It's usually two people. I suggest never to go alone. You know, you don't go into that neighborhood alone if you could all avoid it. You never know what you're going to find out when you make a call like that. So two guys are usually recommended or more, but two at least go on these 12-step calls. And you go in, and it's usually horrendous scenes, but it does really good for both men that are going besides the guy that they're going to help. And having that help sometimes makes all the difference in the world, saves lives. But what's happening now is because of marketing and advertising, the rehabs have marketed their way into, let's call it an easier, softer way. I can buy my way into recovery through a rehab. Yay. Hey, I got enough money. The insurance company's going to pay for it. I can do a rehab. Some people need rehab. They're going to go through delirium tremors. They're going to go through withdrawal. They could go have a heart attack, a stroke, you name it. And, what are they called? Grand mal seizures are not uncommon when an alcoholic deep into alcoholism tries to wean himself from alcohol.
Alcohol detox is extremely dangerous. As opposed to, detoxing from things like opiates. With opiates, you really feel like you're going to die. And the reality is that most people don't die from opiate detox, whereas you're detoxing from alcohol. There is a very inherent risk of death, and that's going to be monitored very closely by some consummate professionals.
Right, and that's where the rehabs really come in, the detox. But once you've detoxed, once you're off the juice, they used to call it in the old days before they had this phenomenon they used to have in the clubs and the groups, bug juice. And someone would sit with you on the couch and give you a shot of alcohol once an hour, once every 2 hours, to monitor the titrating down. And, I mean, it was very rudimentary, but that's all they had. So they did what they had. Or you went to the hospital, but that came in a little later. That wasn't until like 39, 37. So there was been a millennia where that was not available. So my suggestion is go to partner up with the rehabs. Why not? Hey, can we bring a meeting in there? Sure, come on in. They're not paying you anything, and it's going to increase their ability to help people. And I think that really that intention is to help people. There's very few that are just in it for the money. Most of them have great intentions, and I think they would embrace anybody willing to give their time, talents, and treasure to help the next sufferer, because we're really all in this together, but somebody's got to reach out. So that's my two cents. So, Kirk, if you just hang in for a minute, we're going to read how it works. Harold, you want to do that today?
I'd be glad to. So this is Chapter 5, and this is read at the beginning of many, many meetings. I've heard it thousands of times. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. Those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to the simple program, usually men and women who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. There are such unfortunates. They are not at fault. They seem to have been born that way. They are naturally incapable of grasping and developing a manner of living which demands rigorous honesty. Their chances are less than average. There are those, too, who suffer from grave emotional and mental disorders, but many of them do recover if they have the capacity to be honest. Our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we are like now. If you have decided you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, then you are ready to take certain steps. At some of these, we balked. We thought we could find an easier, softer way, but we could not. With all the earnestness at our command, we beg of you to be fearless and thorough from the very start. Some of us have tried to hold on to our old ideas, and the result was nil until we let go absolutely. Remember that we deal with alcohol, cunning, baffling, powerful. Without help, it is too much for us. But there is one who has all power. That one is God. May you find him now. Half measures availed us nothing. We stood at the turning point. We asked his protection and care with complete abandon. Here are the steps we took, which are suggested as a program of recovery. One, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. Four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Five, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Six, were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Seven, humbly ask him to remove our shortcomings. Eight, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Nine, made direct amends to such people whenever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10, continued to take inventory, personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. And 12, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. Many of us exclaimed, "What an order! I can't go through with it." Do not be discouraged. No one among us has been able to maintain anything like perfect adherence to these principles. We are not saints. The point is that we are willing to grow along spiritual lines. The principles we have set down are guides to progress. We claim spiritual progress rather than spiritual perfection. Our description of the alcoholic, the chapter to the agnostic, and our personal adventure before and after make clear three pertinent ideas. A, that we were alcoholic and could not manage our own lives. B, that probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism. And C, that God
that
could
God
and
could
if he
and would sought. If he were sought. I like
Absolutely.
That. You like that, Harold? There you go. So there you go. Got applause. See? It's, the audience
My
loves
privilege.
It. Well, okay, Kirk, that's enough out of us. And now it's, I like to say, that's enough about me. Would someone else like to talk about me?
I talked about me so much, but I guess I'll go ahead for the audience and for
hey,
you folks.
You know, I never get tired of talking about me. You know, the only reason I listen to another man squawk so I know when it's my time to talk. So the way we work it is what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now, and then what keeps you into maximum service to God and your fellow being. So tell us, when was the first time you drank or drugged and it rang the bell and you heard the angel's wings?
Well, I think everybody has an experience like that, and mine is not too far off. I'll first say that I come from a really nice suburb of Cleveland, Ohio, and I grew up in a very intact family. I was the only child, and I was always I was kind of the miracle baby because my mother had some trouble getting pregnant and keeping a kid. And when I came out, I was like, you know, the precious egg. And my parents' behavior for many, many years after reflected that. And I was kind of kept close and coddled and kind of parochial school bubble to where the need to rebel was, it was more prevalent than I would say the average kid was. So I kind of went with that. I had my first drink when I was 15, and I look older than I am. I always have. So it was very easy for me to, you know, walk into the gas station or the liquor store and buy whatever I wanted because at 15 I looked, you know, 20 already. And through that, I gained what I had been lacking for the first 15 years of my life, and that was popularity and acceptance. And my brain, of course, immediately linked that popularity and acceptance up with alcohol. It's very interesting how that happened. Of course, you know, the normal alcoholic reaction goes, upon taking that alcohol, I was immediately at ease. You know, I had always been somewhat socially awkward. Still kind of am here and there, but you know, spirit keeps me grounded. But when I would drink, everything would be that much easier. And people accepted me because I was the guy that could go out and buy what everyone needed for the party. So, later I kind of found out that I was being used a little bit. And, of course, that I put myself in a place to be hurt. But that's
well, you would have been my friend, that's for sure. I would have picked you as a friend, no doubt about it. Especially, and if you're buying too, you couldn't get rid of me with a stick.
Right, right. All right. So I was always
popular.
Seeking, yeah, I was always seeking that acceptance. I was always seeking that popularity because that is really what I felt that I needed to be whole. For many years, I was not whole as a human and as a real man. And alcohol for me worked for a while. I very much believe in the progression of this, of the disease of alcoholism and addiction. There was a point in my drinking, I'd say from, you know, 15 to 18 and a half, maybe 19, that I could drink and be somewhat successful. I could take it or leave it. It wasn't that big of a deal. What happened was, I moved out of my parents' house shortly after I turned 18, and I moved in with a gentleman who was the same age as me, maybe a little bit older, that, and this is me diagnosing him, I know people are supposed to diagnose themselves, but me thinks that he had the same disease as I do, and he was a little bit farther progressed than I was. So, of course, my mission from that day forward was to catch up as soon as possible.
Well, how
and
old are you at
this
point?
I am 23.
Okay. So what was your childhood like? I mean, was there any – okay, so you get the booze, you went through school okay, you were a good student, got in trouble. What was your, what was it?
I wasn't very much of a – I was a good – I was, you know – people have always told me I'm rather intelligent and verbose and things like that, but my mouth often got me in trouble, in a lot of trouble. I was kicked out of a couple different schools in the sixth grade and in 10th grade just for saying some really, really inappropriate things. And, you know, some cheating on some tests and all that. So I didn't help either.
Yeah, yeah.
So I didn't have much integrity to back up what my mouth was saying. And that was one of the biggest challenges when I first got sober was, you know, my feet did not match what my words were saying. But we'll get to that later.
Sure.
My childhood was pretty okay. But, you know, I was usually in trouble in one way or another. The drinking kind of helped to drown all that background noise out. It was very effective, the fact. So when I moved in with this guy, it went from partying here and there on the weekends to alcohol makes me a better salesman. And alcohol, and I still am in a career in sales. And it's very interesting that I'm able to do that even better in recovery. But the delusion was that the substances made everything better, where everyone else around me knew exactly what was going on. But of course it was a secret, right? So I came under that delusion and began to drink a lot more often. And then the consequences really started to happen. I flipped a car over that my parents had bought me, and I had been drinking. And this has been pointed out to me, and I try and point this out to other men that I work with, that a normal person who's not an alcoholic or an addict would have that experience and look at the wreckage and look at the disappointed parents and look at, you know, the law side of it and go, oh, my gosh, I'm never going to do that again. And my thought was, well, let me try this a different way. And that's what makes me an alcoholic. And I attempted to try things different ways, got into some more substances as time went on, and really just came to the end of being successful probably when I was about 21-ish. I'll rewind a little bit for you. Back in freshman year of high school, I, of course, was riding the bus because you're not old enough to drive a car. And there was a kid on the school bus that rode the bus with us to this nice Catholic school some miles away from my home. And his name was Andy. And he was actually a senior while I was a freshman. And we, and I say we, me and my friends, thought that it was a little odd that a senior was riding the bus with freshmen and even kids from the elementary school. So, and Andy was kind of a, he was kind of appeared a little bit nerdy, if you will. You know, he was a little overweight. He had, you know, glasses, and he was very reserved to himself and quiet. And me, earlier in my childhood, having been bullied a lot, you know, this is before the alcohol came into my life, before the ease and comfort of that drinking took place, I was bullied a lot. And when I kind of got a group of friends around me and got into this, I became the bully. So we would bully Andy for, you know, the entire duration of the bus ride. You know, no really physical abuse or anything like that, but a lot of verbal taunting and things like that. Well, in the middle of my freshman year, I get to school, and this announcement from the principal comes on over the PA, and the principal says, last night at about 8 p.m., a student from the school passed away, and we will give you further details via the television announcement later next period. So I'm thinking really nothing of this. I'm like, okay, you know, because I'm a selfish, self-centered person, you know, okay, whatever, someone died, no big deal, let's get on with the day. So my first period ends, and I'm walking to my second period class, and a friend of mine, Colleen, comes running down the hall, and she's just bawling her eyes out. And I said, you know, what's wrong, and what's going on? And I was very confused. And she said, well, the kid that died was Andy, the kid that's on the bus that we force around with and all that.
Tortured.
Wow.
The guy that you would normally torture died.
Yes. So, you know, I kind of comforted her and consoled her, and I said, you know, that's terrible, and, you know, everything will be okay. So I go to my second period class, again, really not thinking about this whole situation. And the television announcements come on, and the principal is on the little TV in the classroom and says, last night, Andy killed himself, and he committed suicide. And that really kind of shaped my life for the next few years. You know, instantly I was kind of frozen in my desk, and I had some friends in that class who had been on the bus with me and had taken part in that taunting and things like that. And we definitely weren't looking at each other. We were all looking at the floor for the kids who had just been beaten on our butts because we had done something really wrong. And I don't think I've ever felt more shame or more guilty or really, you know, who's going to find out about this? You know, I don't want anyone to find out what's going on, what happened, because I felt very responsible.
Your main concern was being found out. That was your main concern.
My main concern was really being found out.
Okay.
Fast forward about a year and a half later, I'm just getting into my sophomore year of high school, and this was kind of my first experience with intuition and spirits. I was sitting in my kitchen at home, and I was reading the front page of our local paper, and there was an article on the very front page that says, teens victim of suicide's father is looking for answers about his son's suicide. So I looked into it, and Andy's father is trying to find out why his only son died from suicide. And it also talked a little bit about him trying to launch a suicide prevention type, you know, mission or speaking engagement, something like that.
His
father, yeah.
Yeah. Trying to get a healing by turning a tragedy into something positive.
Into where he could help someone. So at this very moment, I had my first experience with real intuition. And something told me, you need to go talk to Andy's father. And I put on my coat, and this was pretty cold. It was fall. And I actually found out where he lived, and he actually lived one street over from me. For all these years, my ignorance, selfishness, and self-centeredness prevented me from actually seeing that Andy and his father lived one street over from me. I walked over, knocked on the door, and his wife answered, which was Andy's stepmother, and said, "Hi, can I help you?" And I said, "I think you might. Is Andy's dad home?" And she said, "Well, you know, he'll be home in probably 15 or 20 minutes from work. What can I do for you?" And I said, "Well, I think that I know something about your stepson's suicide." And she was quite taken aback. She really didn't know what to say. And she just kind of invited me in so we could talk further about it. So we're sitting in the kitchen, and I begin to tell her I feel very responsible for Andy's suicide, and I don't know why I'm here, but I kind of want to help Andy's dad figure out what was going on. So Andy's dad walks in the door, and he shakes my hand and says, "Good to meet you, and what can I do for you?" And I begin to tell him chapter and verse of how we bullied his son and how I felt that we bullied his son to death. And I didn't know what to expect. He could have, you know, taken out a shotgun and blew me away right there. But instead he reacted with love and kindness and said, "I'm so happy that you came and told me this, because up until this point, I really didn't have any answers. I had no idea how my son died." And I said, "Well, if there's anything that I can do, please tell me, because I'm trying to kind of absolve myself of this in some way." And he said, "Well, I've been talking to this organization that's a suicide prevention alliance that they go out and speak to different schools, assemblies, PTA groups, and things like that. And they kind of want me to become a board member. And I think now that you've come and told me this, maybe we can work on this together." And we proceeded to do that for the next year or so. I was privileged enough to speak in about 40 or 50 schools in Northeast Ohio and really tell my story in the public eye. You know, I was featured on a couple front pages and some regional networks, you know, kind of grabbed this story, and even Oprah called. I wasn't on Oprah. She had someone else that was scheduled to be on, so I kind of got bumped. But the interesting thing was that ultimately Andy's memory and the memory of him and his father and the kind of mission that I was on was not sufficient enough to keep me sober. I was speaking at a school in the very northeast corner of Ohio, very near Pennsylvania line, and my girlfriend at the time worked right up there, so I went to go visit her before I was going to talk to a group of freshmen and sophomore high schoolers from this big high school out there. And, of course, by this point, my alcoholism is to the point where I'm going to have a few drinks in the morning to kind of get easy and get right and get normal. And she wasn't aware of this, and I made the mistake of using her truck that was kind of up and the seat was elevated, and I had this bottle of alcohol under the seat. So I pulled up and greeted her and made the mistake of leaving the door open, and she saw the bottle of alcohol under the seat. She knew exactly where my next destination was to go speak to kids, and she looked at me and said, "What the heck do you think you're doing? And I didn't have words because no one had ever confronted me like that. And my immediate thought was, well, what am I doing? I am drinking before I'm going to go talk to kids about not bullying people, anti-suicide, happy message about, you know, depression meds and talk therapy. And here I am, drunk. That was my first moment of clarity. And looking back on it, I know, and it's been cemented in me, that no human power can keep me sober. Because the girlfriend couldn't keep me sober either. And I eventually lost that relationship as a direct result of my drinking and drugging. I never spoke in another school or really about this whole thing after that day. I spoke at that school, I left, and I did not take any more calls because of the shame I experienced in that moment. It may be something I get back into, I don't know, but it's been many years. And it's liberating when I tell my story to kind of talk about that, because these days, you know, having some near-death experiences, I'm living for more than just people that are here on this planet. You know, I'm living for people that have died too. So my experience in that whole realm was that nothing was going to be able to keep me sober, not even myself, and I needed to experience something greater. And I certainly didn't find that in any of the 12-step fellowships that my hometown had to offer. The first room I walked into for a meeting of a fellowship, some guy basically chased me out of there with his words because I wasn't sure what an alcoholic was. Someone had asked me, "Are you an alcoholic?" And I said, "I don't know." And said, "Well, basically, F you." And I certainly didn't want to return to a hostile environment like that. I got really strung out on some opiates, and that's my other drug of choice, in the latter part of 2011. And my disease had progressed to that really lonely, dark place that I'm sure a lot of IV opiate users can relate to, where I had no friends, nobody wanted to hang out with me, I was stealing from people I didn't know, I was in a very, very dark place and very near death. And
how old were you at this time? How old
were
you?
Oh, gosh, I was 20.
Okay.
So I had bounced in and out of a couple rehab treatment centers up there, and nothing was really effective because there was no 12-step message that was ever brought to me. It was very clinical, you know, 28 days, you'll be fine, and just kind of relax and eat some food, and you'll be great. And the mental obsession for me never left. So my wonderful mother, bless her heart, kind of got on the phone and started bopping around trying to find somewhere that if I left, I was screwed. Basically somewhere not near home. And I came to South Texas in November of 2011 and met a gentleman named Chris R. And he kind of laid out what the 12 steps were, and I finally found out that I was a real alcoholic. And I finally found out what that meant, that I suffered from a threefold illness. I suffered from a mental obsession that, you know, I was basically alcohol puppet, a physical allergy in which, you know, I put it into my body, and I have no control whatsoever of my drinking or drugging after I put that drink or drug into my body, and a spiritual malady where I suffer from all the wonderful symptoms of depression and misery and pain and causing that for other people and not having any control over it. And from that, I began to recover. You were saying in the beginning of the program that about 25% get sober and stay sober after some relapses, and that's been my experience. I came to Austin, Texas in February of 2012 with some really great knowledge. I could recite recovery books and clinical terms and 12-step jargon till your ears would fall off. However, I was not practicing any of that in my daily life. I got a great job at a car dealership where I was making the most money I had ever made in my life. I found a girl that I immediately fell in love with, because, of course, I was desperately lonely after spending 3 months in treatment, and began to fall again under the delusion that those things could keep me sober. And again, I had the experience that they were absolutely insufficient to keep me sober. I got to have the experience of being homeless here in Austin, bouncing in and out of really seedy places, and having some really, really interesting, death-defying first step experience, where it was no longer any doubt in my mind that I was a drug addict and an alcoholic. In May of 2013, I was here and I had kind of just gotten a job at this gas station, which I was soon to lose because I was drinking alcohol out of the cooler when I would go back and stock the cooler. And, of course, there were cameras there, but, you know, my mental obsession for the alcohol just said, well, screw the cameras. We're just going to try this Kirk's way. And, of course, someone called me on the cameras, and I became really desperate. I called a friend that I had known here in Austin for as soon as I had began to live here, I would see this gentleman at different meetings and said, you know, I'm thinking of trying this again. Can I stay with you for a little bit? And I just celebrated a year of continuous sobriety on May 1st of this year. And as the process goes, nobody really believes me when I tell them all these things that I've done when they look at me, and that's really the biggest compliment that I can get, because that kind of tells me that I've been reborn, as it tells us in the book that the founders of the original 12-step movement wrote, that I'm kind of a new man. And I do a lot of things in the opposite fashion that I would do them when I was out drinking and drugging. Like, I actually make my bed today. You know, I shower, I brush my teeth, and I kind of do some pretty normal, mundane things. But a lot of them are totally opposite in the face of the raging disease, the enemy of addiction. And I stake very close to the program. I take great pleasure in doing those 12-step calls to the hospitals and institutions, and from that, I really garner what I believe to be the key to permanent sobriety, and that's spiritual growth.
Yeah, you know, in the big book where it says our sobriety is contingent upon the maintenance of daily spiritual condition.
Right.
I ask you this, what maintains itself of itself? Nothing really. The sun will extinguish in its day. You're either growing spiritually or you're declining spiritually. There's no middle ground with spirituality. There's no plateau. There's no place where you're safe. It's either you're growing up or you're going down. No flat spot. I call it restless laurelitis. It's fairly common. I've been there. I'm sure most folks of any long-term sobriety and recovery have. You kind of just relax. You go to the meetings. See, originally I was going to get this program through the process of osmosis. Are you familiar with osmosis?
I'm very familiar with that, both personally and through observation.
Danny B is a friend of mine. I heard him, as a matter of fact, in Austin when he used to live in Austin. He's a circuit speaker. Very funny guy. Goes all over the world. And he said, I tried to get this thing through osmosis. And, well, what's that? He says, well, I sit in enough meetings, a lot of meetings. And what happens is the message comes through the floor, up the legs of the chair, up my butt and into my head. And now I'm going to get this thing to that process. So I don't have to work the steps. I don't have to get a sponsor. If you want to hide somebody from an alcoholic, you know what you do? You put it in the big book. They'll never find it there. And then, of course, now the meetings have become the focal point of recovery. Our common jargon today says as much. What do we tell the newcomer? Okay, 90 meetings in 90 days, which is okay. I agree with that. I think that's a good idea. I've tried it without that. No, they need to make the commitment of meeting, getting into the fellowship and making a commitment. I think that's a good idea. But then we tell them your next meeting is your most important meeting. Meeting makers make it. Don't drink was on the grapevine in December. Don't drink and go to meetings. So we keep telling the folks that the recovery is in the meetings. And, of course, then we encourage the new guy to talk. I think that's a huge mistake. People say, well, we need to hear his pain so it reminds us. I say, lady, if you don't remember what it was like, you're probably not finished.
Yeah.
Oh, well, they need to get it off their chest. No, they don't need to get it off their chest in the room. They needed to get it off their chest with their sponsor. So I just to my sponsees not to talk until we've worked step five. Now, it's not going to take a long time. I go through them pretty quick. We're going to get to step five, and now you can chat. You know why? Because until you've worked step five, you have no idea what the solution looks like. All you can talk to is the problem. We don't live in the problem. We live in the solution. So once you've worked step five, now you're starting to see what the solution looks like. Chat away. So what I found is when people talk in the rooms, early on especially, the pain goes away. I don't know why it does. It just seems to do it. It just dissipates. The pain is gone. So once the pain is gone, the motivation to work the steps are gone. So all we're concerned about, when is our next meeting? Why? Because it's a spiritual bump. We start with a prayer, right? Start with a prayer. All AA meetings or recovery meetings are gratitude meetings. An attitude of gratitude is a prayer unto God. And how do we end? We end with a prayer. That's called a benediction. So we have an invocation, we have gratitude, and then we have a benediction. So what are we going to get? We're going to get a spiritual bump. What is an addict always thinking of? When is the next bump? When can I get my next bump? I heard a guy the other day, he's got 34 years. This is my second meeting today. Why would you need two meetings in one day after 34 years of recovery? Why? You're looking for sponsees? You're chairing the meeting? You have a function in here? Why? Because he's looking to get his spiritual bump. There was a lady, this is my fifth meeting today because I'm feeling really bad and this is my fifth meeting, but you know I'm still feeling bad. So that's telling me that they're looking for the meeting, as a solution to recovery. And it's not the meeting. It's the steps with a sponsor. What do you think of that?
I think that's extremely true, and it kind of relays my experience early on with going to certain meetings and hearing about the problem. I wasn't aware that different meetings existed, and what I was going to were really speaker meetings, and the unfortunate speaker meetings are great when they are talking about the solution. I hear a lot of that in Austin for the speaker meetings I go to, because I know a lot of these guys. But the speaking that I was hearing about was drank, when they drank, how they drank, who they drank with, where they drank, the consequences.
How they felt when they drank, the consequence, right. The drunk log. We call that the drunk log.
Right, and that's all I was hearing. I wasn't hearing, and after they would talk about that for 55 minutes, they would go, and I've been sober for 23 years, the end. And no one, and I would go, okay, great. You know, that was a great meeting. And I would go home and go, what did I just hear? I don't even know, you know? We're not talking about working the steps or anything like that. You know, I'm hearing all about bad stuff that happened, and I'm not hearing about solution. And for me, you know, I work with sponsees, and we'll want to get to step five in like a week. You know, my understanding of this disease is that when I sit across from a guy who's fresh, he's dying of a disease that nothing can cure, to my knowledge, whether this is opinion or not, nothing can cure this. But we can really kill it with spirituality. We can kill it with working the steps and some good 12-step elbow grease. You know, for me, I had a great first-step experience, but I didn't know what any of it meant because no one sat down with me and gave me a failed dose of alcoholism. You know, no one sat down and said, okay, you know, let's talk about this higher power thing. And a God of your own conception, you know? And someone did sit down with me eventually, and we worked that. And going to meetings became something that I do to pick up sponsees, like you were just saying. And I go to, like, 2, 3, maybe 4 meetings a week, you know? But I'm there for the newcomer. I'm there to share my experience, strength, and hope like I am right now with you guys.
Right.
Now,
and
through that, I have
you're supporting, right. You're supporting the meetings, and you're looking for sponsees or somebody to work with. Yeah, that's fine. I can, but to go, to be selfish to go to the meeting is what I find to be the common thread. I don't know why. Maybe I should make a judgment, but that's what I see. I'm only telling you what I see. And I think it's kind of ludicrous sometimes that the meetings have gotten that much power. And, you know, and you're going to hear a lot in a meeting. You're going to hear, I like to think of an open discussion meeting as a cross between a self-help program, group therapy, and an agnostic revival. Mm. You're going to hear a lot of stuff that is not AA program. You get 15 alcoholics in a room, you're going to get 20 opinions. And it's going to be confusing to the new guy. That's why I think the new guy needs to be grabbed right away with a sponsor and start working the steps. Because what he's going to hear in the meetings not necessarily is going to be big book, 12 and 12, or agreed program literature. Once he gets through, and then I tell my sponsees nobody wants to bite it, but after step five you can be a temporary sponsor. All sponsorship is temporary. It's either temporary for a day or temporary for a lifetime or anywhere in between, but that's still fresh, and you don't learn the steps until you teach the steps. Our one immunity from alcohol is intensive work with another alcoholic. This activity works when other activities fail. So, okay, we get that. It's a that's an understanding. Step 5 in the 12 and 12 really lays it out, but nobody seems to grab a hold of it until we've spoken with complete candor to someone and they've done the same with us. We still didn't belong. 5 was the answer. It was the beginning of a true kinship between God and man. So what does that mean? Not only do I have to speak a fifth step, I have to hear a fifth step. Who hears a fifth step? A sponsor hears a fifth step. So until you've heard a fifth step, you still didn't belong. You were circling the field, waiting to run out of spiritual gasoline, and then it's another crash and burn. So what I'd like to see, if I was king, of course that's never going to happen, would be making hearing a fifth step a rite of passage in AA. No, you can't be a GSR unless you've heard a fifth step. No, you can't be a DCM until you've hit a fifth step. You can't chair a meeting until you've heard a fifth step. Oh, but there's not enough people coming in. Well, I guess you're going to have to get on your horse and go find them.
Yeah.
If you want to belong. See, then we would see AA grow like it did early on. But not until this is going to happen. Because the rooms that go empty. You know, anytime I see like a half-empty room, we're going, there's 140 million drunks in the world. Did you know that?
Yeah.
According to Google.
Right.
Yeah, Google, you know, 1,000 years hence, the anthropologists will have concluded that as a society, they all commune with an all-knowing God named Google. And according to Google, there's 140 million drunks in the world. Now, according to the GSO, that's not the KGB, but the General Service Organization, last census of 2010, there was 2,100,000 in the rooms. Well, what's up with the other 137,900? You know, that's an awful broad field to work with. You know, how come we're not getting to these folks? They're there. But anyway, that's okay. I'm off my box. All right, I'm stepping down. Okay. So what do you do now to stay in maximum service?
Well, I've had some of my most profound spiritual experiences through a couple things. As far as staying in service is concerned, that's a big one. I really love working with men that are just like me, that are drug addicts and alcoholics, and taking them through the steps. You know, I've been blessed where, you know, I have a day job, but somehow I'm afforded the time during lunch and after work and at meetings to sit down with these guys and get them through the steps so they can step out and share that solution that we've been talking about. You know, the other thing that I do is I, of course, like a lot of folks that like to stay spiritually fit and like to stay sober for the rest of their lives, is go to those hospitals and institutions like we were talking about earlier in the program. You know, go into really, really seedy detoxes and telling men and women that they don't have to drink or drug again. And when you tell someone that hasn't heard that before, it's like all of a sudden you kind of see a little bit of light go on, and we haven't even worked the steps yet. Because you're interested, you've got their attention, you know. And I also find it fun that someone who thinks they've worked some steps before, you tell them that, and they kind of slough it off. And then you tell them, well, this is how I did it, and this is how I, you know, came to believe in something bigger than me. You know, the fact is that Kirk isn't the biggest thing on this planet was my first spiritual experience. And it was this huge, almost relief that I didn't have to act like God anymore. Because if I look at my past behavior, that's what I did. And I tried my best to maintain that because it was fear manifesting itself. For me, fear manifests itself in a lot of crazy ways. One of the biggest examples was, you know, when I was in high school and all that, with that whole bullying thing, I'm so afraid that no one's going to like me that I have to overexert myself to really make everyone love me, and then I end up coming off like a complete a-hole. And that's fear manifesting itself. And I get to talk about that.
Did you know that the number one fear is speaking in public?
Yeah, that sounds about right.
Yeah, well, Google's got it too, but I've heard that for years. That it's enough, and you could see that. It's more so than the death of the body, the death of a child, the loss of a home, wife, or job. At first blush, it doesn't look like much compared to those real disasters of life until you realize that ridicule is death to the ego. And the ego will sacrifice the body on the altar of pride in a vain attempt to stay alive. The preacher said, vanities of vanities, all is vanity. Pride, the disavowment of God or the need thereof. You know what my number one fear is? Nobody will ask me to talk. Anyway, so now you had a radio show you had mentioned?
Yes, this would be about 8 or 9 months ago. A friend of mine went to kind of a meeting of the minds of the folks here in Austin that are talking about this recovery-oriented system of care and how we're going to be more available to addicts and alcoholics and get them the care that they need. And one of the gentlemen, my executive producer and the director of Soberhood, Jason Howell, was talking about this podcast that he had produced, and he was kind of looking for some help on it. And, of course, you know, I always think that I have something interesting to say, whether I do or not. And I felt that I had a voice that might sound okay behind a microphone.
Sure.
And I met with him, and he said, well, this is the podcast, and I think you'd make a great host. So I started my adventure on Recovery People. It's a podcast that we release weekly on iTunes and at recoverypeople.org. And we make a great team because I'm rather 12-step centric, and Jason is very systems of care and thoughtful and artistic, and what are we going to say that's going to make people really think? And recently we were awarded a grant from the federal government for the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Service Administration's Million Hearts Initiative. So we're talking about the 8 dimensions of wellness and what we can do with that in our recovery, whether it be occupational wellness at my job, financial wellness, physical, and things like that. And we've met
Give me the name of that again. Somebody was suggesting I should apply for a grant. Since I'm pulling all this out of my pocket, you know, somebody said, hey, how about a grant? I said, so maybe you're the answer. Give me that info.
Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration. They're the folks that lovingly bequeathed us with this grant, and that's allowed us to really grow our audience and get some really great people on the show. Coming up, we're going to have Bill White, really the kind of the modern-day godfather of recovery, and we're going to talk about his new book, which he actually revised. And you can find him at williamwhitepapers.com. And we're going to talk about the history of recovery and slaying the dragon, the history of addiction treatment and recovery in America. So we're going to have some really great guests, and we've been able to have some really great guests on the show and kind of talk about this thing, you know, how do we grow in our recovery in these different areas of life. And that's kind of been our focus lately. It's really broadcasting the culture of recovery, you know, and faces and voices of people in long-term recovery. Myself, Jason, everyone on the team is in recovery and long-term recovery. And most of the people we have on the show are also in long-term recovery. So it's a peer.
All right, so the name of the show is Recovery People, one word, right?
Yep, Recovery People, one word, recoverypeople.org. And if you get the podcast app, you know, iPhone or an iPod, iPad, whatever, you can find us on iTunes. Or if you just want to listen to us on any other platform, it's recoverypeople.org.
So if I go to recoverypeople.org, and that'll direct me to the podcast.
It will direct.
You have all the archives.
We have all the archives back to when it was just Jason and some other folks, and we also have a resource directory there, so people can find different organizations in their community. And this is a very much an Austin Region 7 thing. So Austin, College Station, Waco, a little bit east and north, find resources in their community to
detox,
grow their recovery. Of course,
you have
you know, there's sure, absolutely,
okay. Yeah, you know, I think there's a real demand for that. I don't know if I don't have the resources, but if you had the resource to do a, what do they call a widget? What do they call when you put in a plug-in on your phone? An app. Have a detox app where it would list all the free detoxes in any given zip code. Or any of the, or all the detoxes listing from free to expensive, because some people need a detox, they need it right away, but they don't know where to start or where to go. I think that would be a tremendous idea and probably would help grow your show.
Quite possibly. We're considering all kinds of options, and we can always go in many different directions because we've been afforded that creative ability. Because it's a podcast, there's no FCC to mess with us, and we can really kind of pilot the direction in which our show is going. And we've received a lot of positive applause from this wellness initiative. And a lot of that is health-based. And, you know, as a matter of fact, one of our first episodes was about heart health and how, as a population, people in recovery are so much more susceptible to heart disease and cardiovascular disease and heart attack than people not in recovery. A lot
Tell
of
me
us,
about it. I went through heart surgery a year and a half ago, and it was related to my drinking and using many years before.
And a lot of us are smokers, and we actually just had an episode, which will be out soon, where we talk about smoking, the action of nicotine on our body, and it's no secret, I'm a smoker. And, you know, we're talking about some of the free services here in Austin where folks can go to get free help with smoking cessation. We also, one of the very fun things we did was, have you guys ever heard of AccuDetox?
No.
Acupuncture? AccuDetox. It's acupuncture in the ear that helps folks maintain health and detox from many things, from heroin to nicotine. And we went on air. We got kind of a baseline and talked a little bit about it. And then we actually had the process done. All three of us, myself, Jason, and my co-host, Sandy, all got acupuncture, came back on, and talked about our experience. And it was a very neat, interesting thing because that stuff, for me, was very relaxing. I actually fell asleep, and it kind of helped to ground me for the rest of the night. And my thinking was free of any alarming things, and it was quite a fun experience. So we had a lot of fun with the podcast. It's been great.
I found the website. It's really a nice-looking website. So you can, everybody, you can find it on recoverypeople.org. It's easy.
Absolutely.
All right. Any last words, Harold?
Well, this has been a great program. I really, really appreciate our guest for his courage to go to that young boy's house and talk to the dad about what happened. And the dad had the ability to respond with love, and that really was an important key to the rest of life. That's a really great story. Really interested in hearing more about that. I'm going to subscribe to the web page. So thanks for coming on. I really appreciate it very much.
Well, thank you guys for having me. It's been an absolute pleasure and an absolute honor to meet you guys. And I'm sure I'll be hearing more of you, and you might be hearing more of me here in the future.
Oh, great. Definitely. That'd be great. Yeah, let's stay in touch.
Very good. Thank you very much.
Thanks again. Well, in closing, I'd like to say Rum Radio and rumradio.org, we're in 151 foreign countries, including Mississippi, 2,800 towns, cities, and villages, and between 2 and 300,000 hits to the website. So we're moving right along, but got a lot of traction on Facebook. I believe it's helping. We get letters from people back that this stuff came exactly when they needed to see it. So remember, if you're looking for good, solid recovery sponsorship information, we'll see you on the radio, rumradio.org. Good evening.
Good night.
Afternoon. Good night. Bye.